Ladies and gentlemen, good evening, and welcome to the Lowy Institute at the NGV series. My name is Anthony Bubalo, and I'm the Research Deputy Director and Research Director at the Lowy Institute, and it's my pleasure to welcome you here for this look ahead at the year in foreign policy. I'm very fortunate to have with me here tonight some of my colleagues at the Lowy Institute who will, together with myself, look at what will be the big issues, at least the big issues that we think will be big this year in international affairs and in foreign policy. To my immediate left, we have Dr. Ewan Graham, who's the director of the International Security Program at the Institute, Jonathan Pryke, who is a research fellow in our Melanesia program, and at the end, last but by no means least, Alex Oliver, who runs our polling program at the Institute. A great array of expertise with which to interrogate some of the big questions of the year. And I'm going to start off tonight by talking with some of my colleagues, getting them to tell you about the things that they think are going to be big this year, and then we'll open up to questions from the audience. The first thing I wanted to ask them, obvious question to each of them, to Ewan, to Jonathan and to Alex, to Ewan, in East Asia, in East Asian security affairs, which is an issue that you particularly look at, when you look ahead at the next 12 months, what are the big things that you'll be focusing in on, the big defining issues for your part of the world?
Well, these days, there's no such thing as a slack year in regional security. I think 2016 is certainly not going to be an exception to the recent trend. Three areas I'd like to touch on, and we'll start at home, because this year is going to be a big year for Australian defence. We've got an overdue white paper, which I predict will be out by April, at the end of April. I don't think it will be any later than that. That white paper, it's only 2 years since the last one, so you might ask what really has changed. One difference will be this is the first white paper which is supposed to be fully funded, and people will be, I think, scrutinising it to see whether one potential difference between Mr. Turnbull and Mr. Abbott is his willingness, or the willingness of the current administration to actually put the money where the mouth is and reinvest in defence modernisation. And so sort of drill down into the details of that defence modernisation. Another thing that will be particularly scrutinised in the white paper will be numbers of submarines in particular. Submarines, of course, come extremely expensive. If the magic number of 12 is repeated, and I'm not saying that that will happen, but it certainly, I think, the odds are closing on that. It may be fudged in a range of 9 to 12, but it's certainly going to be more than the present six. Then that is going to be a huge project. Slightly different from the white paper. I don't think we'll have, a firm decision on which of the three foreign bidders will be chosen. That will probably come middle of the year. But we're talking about the largest public infrastructure project in Australian history, bar none. So it's an extremely important decision. Strategically, it's also going to be very key for Australia because a lot of the conventional deterrence capability that Australia will look to for the next 30 years is going to rely on that platform. My prediction is that it's Japan's race to lose now. I think it would be very difficult for France or Germany to compete with Japan on strategic grounds, just because Japan of where it is, also being a key US ally in Asia. And we've seen a dribble of reports indicating that the US has at least a sort of tacit preference for Japan for that reason. So I think it's the odds are closing, but the decision may actually play out much later in the year. And I think for $30 or $50 billion worth, it's not something you want to rush into. Final area in defence, which is a segue to my next area I would like to look at, in the South China Sea, that's also another potential decision that confronts the Turnbull administration, where we might see some blue water between him and Mr. Abbott on the willingness to actually put our armed forces in the South China Sea. And this, already, it's an area where Australia does operate. We do flights, we do patrol flights on a regular basis. They've actually increased in the last 18 months through the South China Sea, and ships that go through there too. But the key difference is they haven't gone within 12 nautical miles of any of the features that China has been pouring concrete on for the last few years. If Australia does decide to do that, I think the likelihood would be that it would be an aircraft that goes within 12 nautical miles. One of the areas where I think Mr. Turnbull is certainly likely to be more cautious than his predecessor is to use the armed forces. He may be willing to invest in their modernization, but I think in terms of actually using them and sending them overseas, I think my hunch is he's likely to be play that more carefully, whereas Mr. Abbott might have sent a ship. In the South China Sea more broadly, I think 2016 is also going to be a continuing hotspot for two reasons. China looks at the United States. It's an outgoing administration. This is probably the best time in terms of not getting pushback from Washington, in terms of closing their gains, maximizing their control over those islands. So I think we'll likely see an acceleration of infrastructure being put on there. Whether they will fully militarize those islands, again, depends on what the United States does. The US is in a difficult position because on the one hand, its credibility is on the line if it doesn't continue to do these freedom of navigation operations. But if it goes in too heavy-handed, it risks handing an excuse for China to go into fast gear and put full-grade military infrastructure. So it's a delicate balance that we're seeing between the US and China playing out in the South China Sea. One other thing that could, a variable that could influence that potential spanner in the works is in the middle of the year, we should get a decision from The Hague on the Philippines, which has pursued a court case against China in the South China Sea. And if, as expected, that ruling goes China's way, well, China said it's not going to participate in the case. We won't see any change from that. But that might make a difference, too, in terms of China wanting to maximize its control on the ground, to send a message, in other words, to the Philippines that you may have won the case, but we'll still be there on the second day and we're not leaving. Moving further north, North Korea would be my third area, because in Northeast Asia, that's where the bulk of the trouble spots are, after all. That's where the key populations, the key economic centers, and the key military capabilities are located. In some senses, we've seen a stabilization in the last year. Japan and China have become used to patrolling more regularly and more professionally around the islands that are disputed in the East China Sea. But we can always rely on North Korea to be predictably unpredictable. And 2016 literally got off to a bang with a nuclear test, the fourth in its series. And then within a month, that was followed up by a satellite test, which has a clear overlap to the missile technologies that would be required for North Korea's presumed objective, which is to develop an intercontinental ballistic missile with a range to reach the United States and ultimately to be able to take a nuclear weapon. And that clock has now got a little bit closer to midnight. And my prediction, perhaps you in the room have grown used to, you've seen the film before, North Korea, after all, has continued to do this for the last 10 or 15 years, so what's so different? What I think is different now is the international environment is less permissive for North Korea than it's been in recent years. The relationship with China is at an all-time low. South Korea has just pulled out of its only remaining inter-Korean engagement project in the Kaesong Industrial Complex. And Washington, it's an outgoing administration, but it got its fingers burnt 4 years ago trying to do exactly the same by concluding a deal with North Korea. Where I think there is room for miscalculation is, and this is where personality comes into play, such a centralized system where a leadership cult effectively is what the country's legitimacy is based on. We have a young man still in his 20s trying to prove himself domestically, and he needs to have successes. He may be now feeling rather confident that he's got a nuclear test and a rocket test successfully under his belt. But if he's trying to use this to strong arm the US into concluding an agreement before Obama leaves office, I think he'll be sadly disappointed. And what we have seen is his willingness to take a greater risk than Kim Jong-il. So that's what I worry about, is that there is a chance, I think, for a full-blown North Korean crisis later this year.
Ewan, I want to draw you out a bit more on the China-US relationship. It didn't seem that long ago that the relationship was a bit more up in the air, in the sense that people were talking about it being, you know, potentially conflictual, but potentially cooperative. we now seem, in the last couple of years, to be heading down the kind of path towards to a tenser, more conflictual relationship. Do you see that continuing this year? Is that, are we heading down an almost inevitable path of conflict between these two great powers, or is there still time for a reassessment, a rethink on both sides?
It's evident from recent visits to Washington just how that attitude you talk about has become much more fixed. I mean, there are still considerable shades of opinion towards China across the US system, and that's actually been reflected in the relative softness of the US approach on freedom of navigation, because on a global agenda, the US still needs Chinese cooperation on a variety of fronts, North Korea being one of them, climate change being another. So we've seen also actually surprising caution from Washington. But really behind that, you see an increasing exasperation in the US that China is not being the preferred responsible partner that hopes were placed in it, and that from the Chinese side, you know, the continued formulation from Xi Jinping of a new great power relations has actually manifested into something rather more conflictual and spoiling. Mm. So I think a competitive dynamic is certain to continue. But if you mean conflict in terms of hot conflict, I think that's where still US-China is recessed at a point at which it's more likely to play out through proxies and through the kind of shadow game that we've seen in the South China Sea rather than flaring hot. But that doesn't mean there aren't risks for allies, and Australia's, I think, certainly going to feel the heat. And that's something that Turnbull seems to be personally exercised about. He's often phrased in terms of the Thucydides trap, terms of great powers trampling over and the weak having to suffer what they will. And that's something that I think that a fate that he wants Australia and the other countries of the region to avoid.
The history of the Peloponnesian Wars is getting another great run in bookshops, I think, as a result of all this Thucydides trap talk. Mm-hmm. Jonathan, let's move further south now to the South Pacific, to Melanesia. What are the big issues that you think will define the year in that part of the world?
Thanks, Anthony. I think I'm going to take it a little bit of a different direction, and I'll talk about a country and an aid program. So plenty of time in 10 minutes. First, I want to talk about Papua New Guinea. 2015 for Papua New Guinea was meant to be a year of achievement. They were supposed to celebrate their 40th year of independence. They were hosting the Pacific Games in Port Moresby to show Port Moresby as a cosmopolitan global city. And they were also bringing online the first round of revenue from the largest natural resource project in Papua New Guinea's history. Instead, 2015 didn't really play out that way. At the end of the year, thanks to financial mismanagement and the collapse in global commodity prices, the government revenue has collapsed by 20%, which in turn led to a 9.4% budget deficit to GDP. Now, that level of deficit is unsustainable, particularly in a market where a lot of local lending and domestic and international lending has dried up. So it's led to a slashing of core services across the board and cash shortages as well. Just month to month, the government is finding it difficult to pay their bills. This is also compounded by a emerging or continuing foreign exchange crisis in the country. The government is propping up their foreign exchange reserves by rationing access to foreign exchange to the private sector. This is, of course, dampening the ability of the private sector to operate and suppressing business and consumer confidence in the country. Meanwhile, the government has significant challenges that they need to address very quickly. The first is PNG is currently suffering through perhaps the worst drought in their history, and the government has done very little to actively respond to it. The looming 2017 elections were budgeted for 170 million kina in last year's budget, and the National Election Commission was actually allocated 10 million of that. So they are not in any position at the moment to effectively run next year's elections. They also still remain committed to hosting the APEC Leaders Summit in Port Moresby in 2018, the cost of which is a burden for any developed country to host. And if anyone's been to Port Moresby, they'll know that it's nowhere near ready for that sort of event. So what does that mean for 2016? There's limited options for the PNG government right now. They're putting a lot of confidence into raising a sovereign bond that will help alleviate both the foreign exchange crisis and the cash crisis that they're facing. But given the weakness that they're approaching the international market to get this bond, it's unlikely or unknown whether they'll actually be able to achieve this bond raising, and there is no plan B. But anyone who's worked in PNG, when you walk into the Port Moresby Airport on the sign saying welcome to PNG, it also says the land of the unpredictable. So I'm not going to sit here and say that there's going to be a crisis point at some point in 2016 and the IMF is going to come flying in, but the stakes are certainly getting higher and something does have to give at some point. So leading to my second point, the question could be asked, well, where is Australia in all this? Where do we fit? And we are still there. We still have a $550 million aid program in Papua New Guinea, but our leverage and influence in the bilateral relationship has really been muzzled and diminished, largely driven by the Rudd, Gillard, and now coalition government decisions to host our asylum seeker policy on Manus Island. That has also been compounded by a few bilateral ill decisions, such as setting up a post in Bougainville without consulting with the PNG government, and then also having a, I think it's safe to say, relatively incompetent High Commissioner, and then an empty seat for the last 6 months. We finally do have a new High Commissioner in PNG. He served as the head of the Australian Aid Program for 10 years. The hope is that 2016 will start to see the rebuilding of the bilateral relationship, but it's from a very low base, and the challenges that PNG needs to address need to be addressed now. So we don't have the time or the luxury to really wait for this relationship to be rebuilt over 6 to 12 months. So the stakes are certainly higher, but as I said, it's an unpredictable place, so we'll have to wait and see what happens. The second point I want to talk about is Australia's aid program. And as everyone in the room will well know, probably the most disruptive aspect of the Abbott government's foreign policy has been their treatment of the Australian aid program. We've not only seen the largest single year cuts in Australian aid program's history, a real cut of 22% of the aid budget, which has taken us in the direction of being the least generous we'll ever have been in our nation's history when it comes to foreign aid. We've also seen a merger of the independent management of the aid program through AusAid, that was an independent body for the last 40 years, the merging of that back into the Department of Foreign Affairs, with very little strategy or forward planning about how you would retain staff and institutional capacity that are required to run an effective aid program the size of $4 billion a year. And then also at the same time, we have a new aid paradigm implemented onto the aid program by Foreign Minister Bishop. Any one of these three challenges would be enough for the aid program to try and manage. For them all to happen at the same time is, to be frank, quite disastrous. And as I mentioned already, this is really reflected by the just complete loss of institutional capacity in our aid program to effectively deliver aid. Only yesterday we heard that this is reflected in that the Australian government has now decided to tender out our entire bilateral aid program to Fiji, because we don't have the capacity in-house to manage it. Now, to me, that doesn't seem like it's really in our national interest. The aid relationship, particularly with the Pacific Islands region, is probably one of the most important aspects of our bilateral relationship. But it just goes to show just how much of this merger was actually a hostile takeover as opposed to a real synergy and merging of two departments. That is also reflected in the fact that 13 of the 15 senior executives members of AusAid no longer work in the Australian government. The longest-serving aid-oriented member of Mission and PNG has been there for under 2 years. Most people would say that the time of disruption in the aid program has passed. We've seen the worst of it, but this might actually be the year where it really starts to bite. A lot of programs are coming to an end. We have to decide on new funding models, new programs, new ways to spend this $4 billion of aid. And I just don't think that DFAT or the aid program within DFAT is equipped to do it.
Jonathan, I want to take you back to PNG because I also want to do a bit of product placement. In a couple of weeks' time, the Institute is launching its next Law Institute paper published by Penguin Australia. This time by longtime ABC journalist Sean Dorney, who's written a wonderful book on Australia's relationship with PNG entitled The Embarrassed Colonialist. And it's a great look back at the last the PNG's 40 years since it became independent, which just happens to coincide with the 40 years that Sean has spent reporting from there. One of the key themes of that paper is it's time for us to rethink the relationship. Do you agree with him?
Yeah, I do. There's a saying that goes that everything good that happens in PNG has an Australian influence, and everything bad that happens in PNG has an Australian influence as well. We are interlocked and interconnected. They are our only former colony, and we have in many ways turned our backs on them. It's really been a paradigm and dynamic and relationship that is driven by the aid program, and that just really is not enough and not sufficient for our nearest and closest neighbour. I've had three conversations already this year with our incoming High Commissioner to PNG, and he said he is amazed at how much of the discussions at every level with the PNG government is dominated by the problem of visas and how difficult it is for Papua New Guineans just to get into this country. We are really embarrassed. And another example, there are more Polynesians living in Australia, vastly more, 75% more Polynesians live in Australia than are Melanesians. How is that possible? Melanesia, that's our backyard. I mean, you can almost swim through the Torres Strait to PNG, and we just do not let them into our country. I don't know if it's fear of the unwashed or a xenophobia on our end. That, I think, is the starting point. We need to also change our curriculum in our schools to actually educate people about Papua New Guinea. I mean, how many people on the street could you walk up and talk about PNG, and how many of them would be able to tell you that, it was our only former colony? Tony Abbott last year said he wanted to add another star to the star on the flag of Australia for the Northern Territory. Well, there's already a sixth star on the flag of Australia, and that point of the star represents PNG. So, yes, I think it is time to redefine the relationship, and you should definitely read the book to find out how.
Yeah, great book. In all good bookshops in a couple of weeks' time. Alex, I want to turn now to Australia. We have an election this year, sometime this year. Mm. The Prime Minister, Mr Turnbull, will be running against the opposition leader, Tony Abbott. Sorry, I mean...
you got him before me.
What are the big... I mean, you look at our polling, and we often ask in our polls about... kind of key election issues that distinguish the two sides, or the three sides of politics, if you like. Mm. What do you think will be the key foreign policy issues that are likely to feature in the election campaign, if any feature at all?
I wanted to start with the first question, which is a real threshold question for me, which is, you know, whether we're talking, which Prime Minister we're talking about. Mm. You made a joke, but it does appear to be a live issue. It would be, in my view, absolutely disastrous if we were to have not just five Prime Ministers in 5 years, but six Prime Ministers in 6 years. That would make us a global laughingstock.
The most unstable democracy in the South Pacific, right?
Yeah, one of the oldest...
Second, Vanuatu's got us.
Right. One of the oldest democracies in the world, oldest continuous democracies in the world, but currently one of the most unstable looking. But from a polling perspective and some of the work that we've done, it would be incredibly damaging as well, because one of our most striking poll results has been our results on how young Australians feel about democracy, how Australians feel about democracy generally. And when we poll, we regularly find that only between 60 and 65% of all Australians of voting age say that democracy is preferable to any other form of government, which was quite astonishing when we first got that result a few years ago. And a much more worrying result is that there's an even greater percentage of younger Australians who don't think that democracy is preferable to any form of government. So if we were to have yet more political churn, I can only see that the disillusionment with our current political system, which I think is how those results translate. It's not really about whether we believe in democracy. It's about the way that we feel about our current political system, and we've polled on that, and that is the response that's fed back to us, is that young Australians are not seeking a more autocratic type of government. They're actually just seeking better government. Back to your question now, what are the issues for the election? Well, we have polled on elections three times in our 11-year polling history. We did in 2010, we got a report card on the Rudd government. We did in 2013, pre-election of the Abbott government. And then again last year, we took a sort of post-Abbott election poll to find out how he was doing. And those election questions that we've asked have actually been quite reliable predictors of election results. It wasn't what we intended. And one always says that foreign policy is not a big issue in Australian elections. But certainly on the foreign policy issues that we've asked Australians about, they have quite correctly predicted the results of our elections. In 2010, they actually gave the Rudd Labor government a pretty positive score on most of the foreign policy issues that are important: managing the alliance, managing the relationship with China, presenting Australia on the world stage, managing the issue of climate change. They only did badly on whaling and a couple of other more sort of peripheral issues. In 2013, there was a very clear result in favour of the coalition government, and of course that's what the election result turned out to be. And then in 2015, it was a bit odd, and in a sense, it sort of predicted a leadership spill, because on the core issues that the Abbott government was expected to poll really well on generally, and that is managing the economy, managing climate change, and managing asylum seekers, so those core policies of the coalition government as they went into 2013 election, they actually did less than average scores, so less than 5 out of 10 for each of those three issues, while it did pretty well on managing terrorism and security and managing the US alliance, as Australian governments generally do, and so did the Rudd government. So that was a surprise, and I'm not intending to take any credit for predicting a leadership spill, but certainly Those results were surprising, that the government, the Abbott coalition government, did quite poorly on those key issues, its key policy strengths. And so I expect there to be about three issues that are election issues this year, possibly in the foreign policy sphere, but again with the proviso that those foreign policy issues tend not to decide elections. Terrorism is obviously going to be top of the agenda. Whenever we ask about terrorism as a risk factor, as a security risk, and we pose that question to Australians, it is always at the top of the list of risks that Australians perceive, far greater than any risk that we see in our region, far greater than any risk of conflict between China and the United States, far greater than the risk of any conflict in our region between China and its neighbours, such as Japan. So when Australians rank the risks that we propose to them, those near risks in our region are always very low on their calculus, and the highest risk is always risk to our security from terrorism. So at the moment, the government appears to be steering a pretty moderate line. It has moderated the rhetoric in relation to, you know, the terrorist risk from home, the home-based terrorist attacks, and that appears to be playing quite positively. The government also rejected the United States request for more assistance on the basis that we're already providing a huge amount of assistance, the second largest provider of military assistance in Iraq and Syria of the international coalition to fight IS. So I think that's probably the right line, so I can't actually see. It's an issue, but in the current situation, it appears to be a non-issue. Asylum seekers and immigration, obviously, it's a very heated debate at the moment. Australians in our polling history over the last 11 years have always been pretty clear about how they feel about this issue. There has always been a very high concern about unauthorised, was the question that we asked a few years in a row, asylum seekers arriving by boat. The concerns were high. When we asked them about whether they approve of offshore processing, we always get a resoundingly positive response. When we asked last year and the year before about some of the sort of Operation Sovereign Borders planks to that policy, again, a fairly resoundingly positive or supportive response from your average Australian voter. Operation Sovereign Borders attracted a very high 70% of support. Some of the aspects, the more detailed aspects of the policy weren't quite so positive. Less than 50% of Australians, for example, were supportive of the idea that no asylum seeker would ever be resettled in Australia. But generally, they're supportive of the Sovereign Borders policy. However, as I mentioned earlier, when we asked about how the Abbott government was doing on policy generally, and we asked how the Abbott government was doing on the management of the asylum seeker issue, there was this strange, you know, less than 5 out of 10 response on the scorecard, which suggested to us at the time that perhaps the policy in theory prior to the election, as it turned out in practice, was a little bit more unpalatable to Australians. I think probably the other factor that's going to be in play this year that will counterbalance that sort of unpalatableness of the policy in action as we see it today is the European immigration crisis and refugee crisis. And that has probably increased fears of, you know, what would happen if we were to begin to receive that sort of massive wave of refugees coming over from the Syria and Iraq crises. So they're the three issues that I think are going to play in this election. But as I said, one of them's a non-issue. The final one, sorry, US and China. And again, I think the Turnbull government has steered a more moderate line than perhaps anybody was expecting on the China relationship and Australia's, you know, very difficult choice between China and the United States. China as our largest trading partner and the United States as our alliance partner. But at the moment, the line appears to be steering up the middle and, you know, but quite moderated rhetoric in Washington a couple of weeks ago on China and the importance of the US alliance. So it doesn't look as if that's going to create any huge problems for a Turnbull government coming up to an election.
Alex, one of the interesting things that's one of the interesting trends that are coming up in the last few polls are Australian attitudes towards climate change. In the history of the poll, a very early polling back in the Howard days, the poll showed very strong Australian concern for climate change, to the point where it could be argued that it was that reflection of concern that saw the Howard government very belatedly reconsider the signing of the Kyoto Protocol. Then we saw the poll went through that phase where Australians suddenly seemed to become less concerned and some of the public pressure was off. What we've seen in the last 3 years, as you can no doubt attest, is that concern is growing again. Do you see that becoming, and given that it's an issue that genuinely does seem to, a foreign policy issue that genuinely does, and domestic issue of course, that genuinely does seem to divide the two parties, you see that becoming an electoral issue?
That was a really interesting trend, and one of the most striking trends in our 11 years of polling was this massive slide in concern about climate change between 2007 and 2012, where it hit rock bottom, where only around 36% of Australians thought that this was a serious issue we needed to do anything about. Partly, I think, that is a response to the policy action they see in place. When the carbon tax was looking like, or some sort of emissions trading scheme looked like it was going to be implemented, it's almost as if Australians sort of handed over responsibility to the government and said, I don't think we have to worry about that anymore. I am interpolating and trying to interpret some of the responses, but I guess that's part of my job. Now that we have a Turnbull government, despite the fact that nothing's changed and we still have direct action, and Australians in our polling have been broadly supportive of direct action as opposed to reintroducing an emissions trading scheme, I wonder whether concern will continue to rise or whether now they will again breathe that sigh of relief and say, OK, we've handed it over to somebody who knows about climate change and who believes in climate change, and then perhaps we can just relax and not worry about it.
Well, the world has declared our environment minister to be the world's best minister.
Well, absolutely.
So obviously we have nothing to worry about.
Who did that?
Before I take some questions from the audience, let me also throw in a few of my own from the areas of my own expertise, the Middle East. Obviously, not much happening in that part of the world at the moment, so it's very difficult to pick which issue to focus in on. But the one I want to focus in on in particular is the one that gets the most press, and that's the future of Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, and closely linked to that, the kind of the Syrian civil war. It's very clear that until we get an end to the Syrian civil war, the horrendous consequences of that conflict are not going to come to an end. That is first and foremost the really huge humanitarian crisis that this has caused in Syria. We're talking about 250,000 Syrians dead. In 4 or 5 years, if not more. Secondly, the massive waves of refugees that are now heading towards they've arrived in Europe, with more potentially heading there. And the third has been the room that this conflict has given for extremist groups, most notably Islamic State. A few weeks ago, we saw the launch and then almost immediate suspension of the Syrian peace talks. And in parallel, you've also seen in recent months a sizable Russian intervention on the side of the regime of Bashar al-Assad. And it's almost a kind of a race, which one is going to settle the Syrian conflict? Will it be the peace talks, or will it be Russia and Iran's intervention on the side of Bashar al-Assad, which will tip the balance in favour of the regime and see it regain control of not all of Syria, but significant parts of it. And unfortunately, I think it's that latter one which is going to probably win that race over the next year. It may not completely settle it, but certainly there are the Russians have suffered some setbacks, but it does seem to have really shifted the balance in favour of the regime. Unfortunately, there isn't a lot of good news out of that, because as the Russians supporting the Syrian army and the Iranians supporting the Syrian army regain opposition territory, we're likely to see even more refugee flows out of Syria, as we are now seeing out of Aleppo, with what looks like to be the regime's take back of Aleppo from the opposition. And we're already seeing 70, 80, 90,000 refugees heading for the Turkish border. So
But that will also have consequences then for the future of Islamic State. On Islamic State, I think there is better news. I think that we have, in a sense, given Islamic State a little bit more, at least on the ground in Syria and Iraq, more credit than they deserve. A lot of the reasons for their rapid advances in Syria and Iraq and their ability to survive has been related to the fact that not many people have actually been fighting them. It's very difficult to defeat an army that no one really wants to fight, whether it's, you know, you can't do it by air power alone. The groups on the ground, whether it's the Syrian regime or the Iraqi army in Iraq, have been, other than in very specific areas, been unwilling to take on Islamic State. I think that's in the process of changing and will change further. I think the movement will face even stronger pressure. They've lost some significant footholds in Iraq in the last few months. Ramadi, also some areas in the north. They've lost control of a couple of major outposts in Syria. And I think in this year, you'll see some major pressure on their capital, their self-styled capital in Raqqa. Now, on the surface, that seems like good news. Unfortunately, I think in terms of the impact on terrorism, at least in the short term, it's not great news, because we've seen very consistently the way in which when Islamic State suffers reversals on the battlefield in Syria and Iraq, it reacts by sponsoring or calling for or encouraging acts of terrorism outside of Syria and Iraq. The reason for this is the movement understands better than anyone that that the important thing to sustain here is not just its material gains on the ground, but its image. That you attract supporters if you present this image of invincibility, of constant momentum. So when they do suffer those reversals on the battlefield, when they do, when they are seen to stop, they have to demonstrate to members, to supporters, and to potential members around the world that they're still able to maintain that momentum. And they do that by launching terrorist attacks. And you've seen this as a very, very consistent pattern. So I think as they suffer further reversals on the battlefield, and as they start a process by which I think the movement will eventually burn itself out, unfortunately, I think we'll see the threat become a bit more diffuse and you'll see more terrorist attacks. There is the other aligned question to that, which is what happens to the, you know, 20, 30,000 foreign fighters that have travelled to Syria and Iraq to fight. Now, not all of those are with Islamic State, but a sizable proportion are. And I think the real concern for governments around the world, not just in Australia, but also in Southeast Asia and Europe, will be if Islamic State collapses, if it burns itself out, what happens to these foreign fighters, particularly if they all start to leave Syria and Iraq en masse. What it creates is this pool of skilled up, networked extremists. Not all of them may, you know, some may go into kind of conflict zones and other conflict zones in the Middle East. And we've seen the kind of growing IS presence in Libya and to some degree in Afghanistan as well. Others may try to return to home countries. Others not being able to get back into those home countries may go into third countries. Not all of them necessarily will want to kind of continue a life of being a member of a terrorist group, but you've also got the problem of when people have these skills and these networks, they may decide to use those skills for other purposes. So you might see them kind of fold into international, transnational criminal networks. And so it's going to be an issue that the international community together is going to have to manage. Now, that may not happen this year, but it's something that I think the international community needs to start thinking about the day after Islamic State falls. So on that very cheery note, I'll open now to the audience to take some questions. Raise your hand, wait for the microphone, tell us who you are, and please, if you can, make it a question. Down here, down the front.
Marcus Wigan, a recent international relations student at Melbourne. The issue that I notice you didn't mention, like most elephants in the room, was the energy one and the instability in Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. In conjunction with the shift in balance between the sects of Islam, plus the less than stellar reputation of Saudi Arabia as a government, mm-hmm. is a very, very dynamic situation. We have in the Gulf some very rich entities that are very unstable with quite a small shift in perception, and their revenues are declining. I'd be very interested in your commentary as to how this fits into what I see as a highly risky global situation. You can really see the effects in terms of reducing oil prices at the moment from keeping the volume up.
Mm.
But I think this one is something I was surprised you didn't mention. I'd like to know why you didn't mention it.
When it comes to elephants in the room, in the case of the Middle East, it's not so much one elephant. There is a zoo of elephants, and it's just a question of time of trying to get across. And there's a lot to get through, not just in the Middle East, but in the world. So don't read into it. Don't read any conspiracies into it, even though it's about the Middle East, which is full of conspiracies. Saudi Arabia is going through a very definite turning point. I lived in Saudi Arabia in the mid-90s. I've watched Saudi Arabia now for 20 years. And I've tended to be very dismissive of the line that you'd often hear, which is, you know, this year the House of Saud is going to fall. And there's a virtual publishing industry of books. Every year there's a new book saying the House of Saud is going to fall. And I've tended to be dismissive. I'm now paying more attention for a couple of reasons. Low oil prices. Now, Saudi Arabia is not about to go bankrupt. That's not going to happen. The issue is not, though, how much money they have. The issue is how they use it. Because it's an issue of managing expectations. It's people have lived a certain lifestyle. To deliver that lifestyle, which is a key part of the ruling bargain that the Saudi rulers have with their people, you have to deliver on that lifestyle. If you can't deliver on that lifestyle, you have to run your country differently. And that's a challenge they're going to have to grapple with. That's one challenge. A related challenge is that within the Saudi royal family, we have now run out of the first generation, not that they're all one part of one generation because there was big age differences, but basically since the founder of the Saudi state, Ibn Saud, all of the kings of Saudi Arabia have been his sons, all been brothers, half or full. That generation, if you like, spoken of very broad terms, is now almost at the end. The current king, King Salman, will probably be the last. So you then have to make a decision within the royal family. What part of the royal family do you go to? And you're talking about a family of probably 7,000-8,000 princes. So that is considerable. That has the potential to cause considerable rivalries. And we're now starting to see that kind of play out, where you have the current Crown Prince, who's the Interior Minister, Prince Mohammed bin Nayef, and the King's son, very young, 30-year-old, Prince Mohammed bin Salman. And there's very clearly a rivalry between them that's playing out within the family but also outside the family. They may resolve that rivalry, but if they don't, the issue of how you manage lower oil income and high expectations and internal dissent within the family may well collide, and you'll get a period of very serious instability, perhaps more serious than we've ever seen in Saudi Arabia. The back.
My name is Daniel Steedman. I'm a student. I was wondering, Ewan, if I could direct my question to you. Recently, the Chinese Navy, for the third time in the history, managed to get a vessel to circumnavigate the globe, and shortly afterwards, I think I read in The Economist that an admiral in the Chinese Navy basically said, we now have the capability to go anywhere we want unchallenged. How do you sort of see the strategic dynamic playing out in a naval context in East Asia, given that the Chinese are now developing aircraft carriers, the Indian Navy is hoping very soon to launch their first nuclear ballistic missile carrier, and given the distractions at the moment in the US with their own political situation, how do you sort of see the dynamic evolving over the next 12, 18 months?
I think you're right that the maritime dynamic is the key one to focus on within the region for reasons of geography. It's a maritime region. China's circumnavigation of the globe is to be expected as just the precursor of an inevitable globalization of its interests, that the flag will follow trade, and the shift of China's strategic horizons from a historical continental focus to a maritime focus is not necessarily a bad news story. Over time, the big question is whether China will follow, as the Soviet Union did, a similar progression in terms of its acceptance of international legal access to the, as then was, 3-mile nautical mile territorial sea. Now, of course, you have a much more complicated legal regime, but nonetheless, we saw an inkling of that last year when the Chinese Navy also went in inside U.S. territorial waters briefly off Alaska. Whether we'll be able to survive the bumps along the road towards that goal, I think, is the key question. Managing that learning process over the next 15 to 20 years, and I think that's probably less of an issue about China's maritime or naval doctrine. That's a broader issue, a broader risk about China's ability to catch up in terms of its mentality as a state that has a very strong sense of victimhood and having been wronged, of not having caught up because it's grown so quickly, militarily and economically. And I think that's that basic political imbalance is playing out in terms of the bullying and hectoring behavior that we see that seems to be self-defeating because it's creating insecurity amongst the countries that precisely that China's trying to influence in Southeast Asia, pushing them closer to the United States. The US, of course, the US Navy numbers are also continuing to go down. So, of course, many in the US are focused on that. Numbers of naval ships, I think, is an increasingly accrued counter of capability. You've got ships that can do so much more. Focusing simply on the hull count, I think, is a bit of a red herring. But nonetheless, I think it's bound to be the case that China will increase its naval capability. One of the striking things is that it's hardly broken sweat, really, in the last 10, 15 years, where we've seen from a low base, really, it's moved out from being a green water navy now to something that has some pretty potent capabilities. But those potent capabilities, I think, really count in the near seas, as China calls them, in the South China Sea, in the East China Sea. At the global level, maybe even at the Indian Ocean level, whether China is not really a peer competitor of the US Navy, maybe not even a peer competitor of the Indian Navy in the Indian Ocean. What we're seeing there is, I think, more of a shadow game and China playing to the capabilities where it does have some advantage, for example, putting in small numbers of submarines as a way of sort of unsettling the Indians. But in a real balance of power sense, I don't think that counts the same. And we also see bases, the debate about whether China will acquire overseas bases. Well, civilian bases that can support anti-piracy missions in the Gulf of Aden are somewhat different to full combat bases. But really, it all depends where the tension is felt. If you're talking about a scenario in which the US has to fight China in Taiwan, well, militarily, it's already totally shifted there. China's just acquired a an air defense system from Russia that will give it in the ability to entirely cover the territory of Taiwan. So that is a clear, demonstrable material shift, and that will clearly play into the calculations that the US would have to make in that scenario.
Down the front here.
Zara Kempton from the Australian Institute of International Affairs. There's been no mention of trade issues, and I just wondered how the panel see the TPP, especially with the opposition in Congress. We're sort of so pleased that this has happened, but is it really going to? When is it going to happen? And also, how do you see the negotiations with RCEP proceeding as well?
We haven't mentioned trade issues because we left all our economists in Sydney, but I know that Ewan does cover off on some of these issues, so I'm sure he can have a go at it.
Very briefly on the TPP, the bigger question can it be divorced from the security dynamics of the region? What was noticeable was that President Obama, in trying to make the case to Congress, increasingly used the terminology of it's a strategic agreement, and this plays to the broader issue of the so-called U.S. rebalance. To be credible, it can't just be military in nature. It can't just be military and diplomatic in nature. It has to be anchored in a long-term economic sustainability, because otherwise the credibility of the United States, its ability to continue paying for its the premium on its military security guarantee to the Asian allies depends on that economic health. So I think that the TPP is the best game in town, but whether it is a truly game-changing agreement in terms of revitalizing the US economy, on that I think that the jury is very much out, because if we look at the composition of the TPP, the big players, well, Japan obviously is huge, but the smaller players, Vietnam, for example, why was Vietnam allowed into the TPP? I think that is, you can make a political argument for that, but will it really sway the economics? That's my thoughts, and I don't know if the other panelists have.
Sorry, just here. Oh, just behind you.
I'm Diana. I work at Amnesty International, and we're currently running a big crisis campaign on Syria, and I'm really interested to hear your point of view on how you see the election outcome in the US playing into that, given Russia's involvement, and it's quite timely given that the US is very distracted with their own election campaign going on. And if, you know, whoever does end up winning this presidential election, if that will then mean boots on the ground, will that be another proxy war? Are we looking at another Afghanistan here? We're already into this very long, lengthy, protracted conflict as is, and what that could mean for the next 5 years.
The first thing I'd say about the US presidential election and what impact it'll have on Syria and the Middle East is you can very safely ignore everything that's said in the campaign, because none of it is sensible and none of it is going to end up real policy. What will determine policy in the end are the very real limits that the US faces in terms of resources, in terms of the options it has in Syria. And you know, there's been a lot of blame thrown on the Obama administration, saying, you know, Obama is too timid, he's not flexing American muscle. And yes, partly that does reflect Obama's very different way of approaching problems and issues. But it also reflects some very harsh realities, which is there is no public support in the US to send large numbers of American men and women back onto the ground anywhere in the Middle East. And any new president is going to face the same constraint. American defense budgets are constrained. American defense policy faces some real choices now. They look at many of the emerging Chinese capabilities that Ewan mentioned, and they have to make some really hard choices. So leaving the rhetoric aside, I don't think you'll see any significant shifts in American policy on Syria under whoever is elected. I think what you will see is this continued evolution in policy, which is what you're seeing now, where kind of grudgingly, very slowly, you're seeing this, what was originally a very, you know, hands-off air campaign, but air campaign that dropped very few bombs approach to something where you see a more intensive air campaign supported by special forces on the ground, help trying to kind of better mobilize opposition groups against IS. I don't think you're suddenly going to see that policy shift against Bashar al-Assad, because really to do that, you're talking about much larger numbers of troops on the ground. You're talking about an air campaign that would then have to deal with the very significant Russian military presence. And I don't think whoever the next US president is going to be prepared to do that. Sorry, just here first. And then.
Ed Shan, I'm an economist. Just going back to the energy question, it would seem to me if you're looking for something that might be a major destabilising factor in the world over the next 12 months, it would be if the oil price stayed down for an extended period. I mean, PNG has been mentioned, but you could throw in Nigeria, Venezuela, Russia, Libya, and quite a few other smaller nations. It just seems to me that's one of the real threats over the next 12 months, that you could get a whole series of countries where the economics forces political instability.
Well, it's not a threat to me. I love going to the petrol station now and buying sub $1 petrol again. It's fantastic. It's all kind of throwback. You will see, there's no question in my mind that you will see continued low oil prices.
One of the really fascinating things that isn't really commented on enough is there used to be this thing in the Middle East called the risk premium. Whenever there was a war or something bad happened in the Middle East, the price of oil shot up. The Middle East is now going through its most tumultuous period since the end of World War II, since the end of the kind of colonial era, and yet oil prices are at their lowest. So it's like the risk premium has disappeared. Now, one of the key reasons for that is that the Saudis have not been prepared to cut production significantly because, for a very good reason, people talk about, well, you know, they're trying to kind of hit at US shale oil producers, or they're trying to have a go at Iran or Russia, you know, their adversaries. All of those are some small factors, but this is actually pure economics for them. This is business. The last time oil prices dropped, back in the 80s and 90s, they cut production and they lost market share. They're not going to make the mistake this time. And market share is critically important now because most oil markets in the world are not growing, not growing significantly. And lots of oil producers are coming back into the game, Iran, potentially Libya in the future, Iraq. So they will hang determinedly onto that market share, and that means they're not going to cut production in a significant way, and therefore, you know, we can expect to go to the petrol station and still see sub $1 prices, I think, for an extended period. It's great. We're running short of time. In fact, I want to ask our panel one last kind of question, and which they'll need to answer in 30 seconds. There is another election, of course, this year, a US presidential election. So I wanted to just get their very quick comment on what they think the US presidential election means for their part of the world. So Ewan, President Trump, how is President Trump going to deal with China?
Well, the Obama administration's signature Asia policy is the rebalance. I think we'll see that overnight replaced with the imbalance policy to Asia. More seriously, people will focus on China-US dynamic. Trump has actually talked about working with China. He's mentioned China in a tub-thumping way, as you would expect. But as you've alluded to, in US presidential elections, you aim off for a lot of the rhetoric. I think maybe the wild card would be Japan. There's something very 1980s about Trump's view of the world, and he doesn't seem to have moved on from Japan as the, you know, taking advantage. So he continually harps on about making the allies pay more, and I think that could cause a rupture within the alliance. Mm. We had a Lowy interpreter post to take things closer to home, suggesting that Australia should abrogate the alliance the day that Donald Trump wins the election. Mm. That's an interesting policy question to put Canberra's way.
Jonathan, President Trump, does he even know where Melanesia is?
I highly doubt it. I don't think many of our leaders know where it is either. So, yeah, to bluntly answer your question, it's going to have no impact on the Melanesian region.
although if Hillary is elected president, Hillary has shown an interest in the South Pacific. So do you think that we'll see a bit more US engagement in the region?
The US has no bilateral aid programs in the region. They have very little diplomatic representation in the region. Ewan could speak more to the security dimensions of the region as the US pivots back to Asia. But I'm going to stand by it and say that it's going to have very little impact. She's visited, so that's a good thing, I suppose.
Yeah. Alex, we regularly ask Australians about their attitudes to the US. How is President Trump going to potentially shift those attitudes, do you think?
Yes. Well, the last time Australians got cool on the idea of the US alliance, and they've always been very strongly supportive of the alliance this year, it was 80% of Australians were supportive of the US alliance. But it hasn't always been this way. And in 2007, towards the end of the Bush, George W. Bush presidency, it hit the lowest point it's been, where only 63% of Australians, still a majority, but a huge drop in comparison with where it now stands at 80% and in fact higher than that. So we asked Australians at the time, why was it that they felt that way about the US alliance at that point in time? And they might resoundingly named George W. Bush and US foreign policy, not the American people, American culture, which were the other options we gave them. So there is a real risk if we have a President Trump that the support for the alliance will slide. And Ewan's point about Dan Flitton's sort of article in jest that the US alliance would be torn up and we walk
or
away
fired.
From it with one, or be, we'll fire him, yeah. Is, you know, there maybe is a little tiny sliver of a basis to it, that we do sort of lose our interest in the US alliance when we've got some, you know, perceived crazy in charge. And when you talk about Trump and foreign policy, as far as I can see and from what I've read, his foreign policy can be summed up in a statement he made last year, which is he predicted that he's, under his presidency, America's enemies will one day be saying, this guy is freaking crazy. We give up. We give up. So it's a scary prospect.
Well, I think you'll certainly be half right. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have to bring it to a close. Thank you for joining us this evening. I'd like you to join me in thanking our panellists tonight. I'd like to also thank the NGV for hosting us, as they always do so wonderfully well. It's a real pleasure to be down here. We'd love to get down here a lot more often. And we'll see you at our next event. Thank you.